The education of a boy, wrote the Greek historian Herodotus about the Persians, will begin at the age of 5 and finish when he is 20. But in all that time, he will only ever be taught 3 things: how to ride a horse, how to fire a bow, and how to tell the truth. Well, the thesis of today's episode of The Rest is History is that actually the Persians taught a lot more than that. Actually, in fact, that huge amounts today, even in the 21st century here in the West, that we take for granted, that it derives ultimately from Persia. And I guess this is a thesis that may not seem immediately obvious because the Persians don't really tend to occupy the kind of outsized role that other ancient civilizations do in the popular imaginings, civilizations like the Egyptians or the Greeks or the Romans. But speaking for myself, the more I've studied antiquity, written about it, thought about it, the more I've come to think that Persia is like some great kind of underground spring from which infinite numbers of rivers and streams, when you trace them back over the course of the centuries and the millennia, turn out to have sprung from. Dominic, as a modern historian, I don't know whether you would accept that. I mean, I guess even the Iranian Revolution of 1979 slightly plays that role, doesn't it?
I think it absolutely does, Tom. I think actually we in the West sort of tend to forget a little bit about Iran. We're fixated in the 20th century on Russia and China, I suppose, as the sort of antagonists of the West. But Iran, the Iranian Revolution of 1979 seems to me one of the great foundational moments of the contemporary era. So it's the moment that, you know, the rise of the Ayatollahs, of radical Islam, and then the way in which that was exported, and Iran's sort of status as, you know, this, I mean, Iran talks of the United States as the great Satan, but in many ways, Iran has been the great Satan, hasn't it, for the secular West ever since 1979.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that for lots of people, if you say Iran, you tend to think of women shrouded in black veils and old men with long beards wagging their fingers and saying death to America. And perhaps that can obscure the way in which Persia is one of the truly great, rich civilizations of the world.
Yeah, I buy that.
We have someone who I'm sure will agree with that.
Well, somebody actually knows about it.
Absolutely. Ali Ansari, who is a professor of Iranian studies at St. Andrews University, no less, author of A Very Short Introduction to Iran. Ali, thanks so much for coming on. I guess that you would agree. I mean, I know you agree because we've talked about it. This idea that essentially everything comes from Persia. Yes. Everything comes from Persia. You would be happy to go along with that.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that the, you know, the Iranians or the Persians, I mean, we can discuss about the terms that we use. I mean, basically think that their contribution to, you know, human civilization has largely been underrated for the, you know, and largely ignored. And precisely, I think, as both of you have said, because the prism of looking at Iran has been really via the Islamic Revolution of 1979, it's very much coloured our understanding, and it sort of permeates everything we think about Iran. Whereas in actual fact, of course, Iran or the Persians are, you know, have so much more to offer, I would say. I mean,
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I talked about Iran. Tom talked about Persia.
That's right.
Are they the same, or are they two different things that happen to have been in the same geographical location, or is there a continuity?
No, there is a continuity. And I think, you know, my great achievement, if I have one as an academic of Iran, is to finally convince people that actually Iran and Persia are indeed the same thing, certainly in the Western record. So, when we're looking at Iran is the name actually given to the country and the territory, the political territory, or even the culture, if you will, by the indigenous peoples. Persia is really, as Tom will know, is the sort of Greek-Roman sort of rendition and the reflection of a particular people or tribe of Iran. So if you look at a hierarchy, I mean, there's rather a good quote. Ascribed or attributed to Darius the Great, who basically says that I am an Achaemenid by family, a Persian by tribe, and an Iranian in terms of my peoples. So there's a sort of a tripartite division, which works quite well. I mean, obviously, you know, what he means by those things back 2,500 years ago is obviously vastly different to what we might understand today. But nonetheless, it offers us an insight on how those relate. And I think far too many people, Western historians in some ways, confuse the fact, they sort of think that Persia is a different place to Iran, and that Iran sort of basically was invented in the 20th century. And most Iranians would be horrified at this. And most travelers, actually, most Western travelers who went to Iran in the modern period, by the modern period, Dominic, I mean, you know, from the 17th century onwards.
Yeah.
In the 20th century, you know, all recognize this. I mean, they all say in their text, you know, the people who we call the Persians call themselves Iranians. So I think that's very clear. And I think for the avoidance of doubt, before we go forward to our top 10 hits, in a sense, I should also make clear that the term Iranian has nothing to do with the 19th century, you know, European racial connotation of Aryans and this sort of thing. I mean, it's basically a linguistic distinction, a linguistic definition that comes out and is basically applied. I think, and Tom will probably correct me actually on this, but I think, you know, for many Iranians in a sort of historical basis, an ancient basis, I mean, Iran simply meant, as the Franks do, basically, you know, noble born, free born, this sort of thing. So it's nothing, you know, it's really little more than that.
Well, Ali, what, on the topic of how exactly we define Iran or Persia, could I quote something from that great scholar of Iran, Ben Affleck?
Tom, you found your level.
Ben says, Persia is very different from the Arab Middle East in terms of architecture and language. Even though we think of them as one big Middle Eastern area, in truth, Persia is quite distinct. So,
yes.
What a great geopolitical mind.
let's just tease that out, because of course Persia, Iran, whatever you want to call it, is this great upland plateau.
That's right.
And you've got the Zagros Mountains, and then you go down the Zagros Mountains, you're into the kind of the flatlands of Iraq, of Mesopotamia. What historically, what's the relationship been between Persia and the rest of the Near East?
Well, I mean, historically, I mean, if you look at the Iranians or the Iranian peoples, as we describe, as a sort of a, let's take them as a linguistic grouping. I mean, obviously, they have a distinct Iranian language affiliated to an Indo-European heritage, which means that actually the language, that the Persian language, not to confuse matters, but the Persian language spoken by the Iranians is basically much closer to the European languages that we speak. And you see that in sort of mother, father, you know, brother, Mardad, Pedad, Barodad, this sort of thing. So it's actually quite interesting in terms of that linguistic distinction. And of course, the Iranians occupying and having three sort of major imperial empires prior to the rise of the Arab Muslim caliphates of the 7th century meant that they had a certain presence in the Middle East, I have to say, long before the Arabs.
So just give out those three empires. Just give us a span of the ancient history.
So basically, if you look at, to give us some sort of chronological parameters, we have the first Persian Empire, which actually is the empire that most people in the West would be familiar with, which is the Achaemenid Persian Empire, which is the one that covers, you know, everything from Greece over to the Indus and down to Egypt and so on and so forth.
The ones that lose at Marathon.
Well, yeah, but win at Thermopylae, if I might say so.
Yes,
that's like Cyrus the Great, Darius, Xerxes.
Xerxes, all the people that, you know, we know from our biblical and classical experiences. And we'll talk a little bit about more about them, I'm sure, afterwards. And of course, the quote you gave from Herodotus, I mean, I should remind us, you know, of course, Herodotus is technically a Persian subject, isn't he, Tom? So, I mean, he's a bit of a renegade, but he's, you know, he's, and the father of modern, not modern, but the father of history. That's the first empire. And that's the empire that lasts for about 200 years and is basically overthrown by Alexander the Great. And we can, you know, also talk a little bit about Alexander's legacy in the Persian world. Not all positive, you won't be surprised to know. And then subsequent to a sort of a Hellenic interlude, you then get the rise of a new dynasty, which in the Western lingo we know as the Parthians. And the Parthians are actually the longest lasting of the dynasties, quite decentralized. Again, occupying much of the Iranian plateau. And it's with the Parthians that you get the first sort of contest with the Romans and the Roman Republic. And then the Roman Empire, obviously, subsequently. The Parthians last from about, you know, 250 BC to around 250 AD. And then they are subsequently succeeded by probably the most influential of the pre-Islamic Persian empires, certainly as far as Iran is concerned, and that is the Sasanians. And the Sasanian dynasty claims a much longer heritage on the plateau and lasts really then until the mid-7th century, until the overthrow by the Arab the Arab Muslim armies. But it's the Sasanians that really set the scene far more than the previous dynasties, in actual fact. They're the ones that compile a sort of a historical record. They're the ones that actually give the name Iran to that political territory. And if I was to say my first, if I can put it that way, is that, you know, there is a suggestion, which I'm sort of happy to accept, really, not entirely uncritically, but certainly accept, is that, you know, Iran is one of the, if not the first, territorially defined political unit that has a degree of continuity to it from the period of antiquity to the present. So the Iran that is set up by the Sasanians, the Empire of Iran, is basically, you know, the sort of cultural territory, if not entirely the political territory, because it was bigger, it is bigger, obviously, than what we have today, that we find in modern Iran.
So Iran is the first country.
Well, I mean, that would be the claim. I mean, obviously, when we get into it, you know, Iran, from as far as the Iranians are concerned in historical purposes, is the first kingdom. I mean, it's the first dominion of man over nature. So, but that's largely, you know, obviously part of the mythical heritage, but it's one that Iranian nationalists are very, very keen to promote. Some of the chronology goes really quite far back and wholly unrealistic, but I'm happy to sort of chat though. You know, they say it's not just 2,500 years. I mean, let's get it back further. You can sit down and talk to a number of Iranians, you know, and we can extend back. There was quite a famous account actually in the early 20th century when a nationalist historiographer, which I always find quite entertaining, calculated the length of the kingdom of Iran going back through the mythical great epic poem of Iran, the Book of Kings, and he calculated that the length of the kingdom could be traced back 10 billion years. Someone else also pointed out this predated the creation of the world. You know, so I mean, these are things
that puts the Romans in their place.
I know, that's right. So I mean, if you accept that, then everything does begin in Iran. Obviously, I mean,
but Ali, obviously, what complicates the picture in terms of the continuity? Because clearly, there is this incredible sense of continuity, and the last Shah of Iran famously had. Great celebrations at Persepolis, the great Achaemenid capital, and he jetted over cooks from Paris and kind of great extravaganza. And then, of course, we know what happened to him. And I suppose what complicates this picture of continuity is that the Sasanian Empire in the 7th century collapses before the Arabs.
That's right.
They introduce Islam.
That's right.
And to what extent is Islam a radical rupture, and to what extent does Iranian culture come to an accommodation with Islam, and there is a genuine sense of continuity?
Well, I mean, my favourite phrase in all this, and always to disarm my Arab colleagues, is to say, you know, captive Persia took prisoner her conquerors. I've never actually known who actually said that first, but I'd like to sort of lay claim to it. But it's essentially this notion that there have been a series of ruptures in Iranian history, clearly from Alexander the Great all the way through, and you get the Arabs are obviously, and the Muslim conquest is a very serious, almost, you know, psychological, ideological rupture, obviously, and bringing a new religion, a new calendar, so on and so forth. But then also you have the Mongol invasions of the 13th century that are particularly devastating on a socioeconomic level. But in all three cases, I mean, you find this sort of cultural confidence of the Persians, and I'll use those terms interchangeably now in order to really confuse our audience. But that sort of Persian cultural confidence comes through. And with the Arabs, what you find is that the Iranians basically take Islam and turn it from what is essentially an Arab religion into a global universal religion, in which, you know, non-Arabs are equally valid and therefore Persian.
So Ali, what you're saying is Islam is actually Persian.
Well, there are some, I think that would be pushing it a bit, to be perfectly honest. There are a number of people in Iran who would certainly claim that the Islam that you see today in terms of a global universalist religion is really something which has been de-Arabized and
Persianized.
Yes, I mean, to some extent. I mean, why quibble? But it's that's certainly one of the views. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, I have to say, subscribe to that. But however, it's obviously a religion adhered by all, and that's the argument. Of course, you see that with Shiism as well and other things. But you see it also with the Mongols. Iran is the only part of the Mongol Empire that basically absorbed the Mongols within Persian culture. In China, they expelled the Mongols, you see, but the Iranians somehow just absorbed them. And you still, you know, and you still see lots of traces of the Mongol and Turkic conquest in Iran.
Ali, you've given us this huge list of things that you think that Persia basically invented, that for which we should be getting down on our knees and groveling before the Persians in gratitude.
I wouldn't go that far. We're very magnanimous. No. I mean,
Frustrating ourselves before the great
Frustrating
king.
Ourselves, yes, yeah, of course.
No, I wouldn't want you. I just think that, you know, there are a number of... I mean, the one thing which I think you should acknowledge is that basically, you know, Persia is the midwife to the West, isn't it? I mean, there would be no yes. West without the Persians.
Okay, so Ali, on that theme, you've prepared a list of yes. top 10 things that the Persians have given the world?
I mean, I have to say I felt very restricted by 10, but
there look to me to be more than 10 on this list, Tom.
Yeah, because there's some certain subsets, aren't there, really?
Basically, Ali has come prepared for 10 podcasts.
Okay, well, how long have we got? We've got, what, 5 minutes left? 10 minutes, I guess, for this half?
We'll rattle these off.
Right, so let's kick off. What's your first selection?
Well, I mean, I think we can start with that sort of issue of Persia being the first kingdom and basically I will elicit here the support of that great German philosopher Hegel to remind us that history begins with the Persians. So our understanding of history as a progressive movement, in a sense, of enlightenment, if you will, is really begins with the Persians. Now, like all good historiography, that we don't like to quote the next clause that Hegel puts out, that, you know, it starts with the Persians and then left them. I wouldn't want to use his next phrase. Let's stick with the first part. But I think, you know, this idea of Iran as the first kingdom, the first dominion of man over nature, the first place where history begins effectively, and, you know, as I was saying to Dominic earlier, this territorially delimited state, in which is also the midwife, in a sense, in an ancient sense, to that concept of the West. So it's interesting, as you both said, you know, we don't have this notion of Persia as a great civilization in the same way as we have with the Romans and the Greeks and even the Babylonians or Egyptians, to be honest. But nonetheless, we are there as best supporting actor. And I would like to move us from best supporting actor really to center stage. I think we should be getting the best actor award, frankly.
Ali, did that all kick off with Cyrus the Great? Was he the person who basically created Persia?
Yes, depending who you talk to. I mean, I think in the popular understanding, the father of the nation, as was noted, is basically is Cyrus the Great, who basically binds the Medes and the Persians together into the first of these Iranian empires, and this Persian Empire from, you know, 559 BC to, when would it be, Tom, 333 BC, something like that. That's the first of the Persian empires, which basically establishes, and I would add to that, the first universal empire.
Yeah, I completely agree about the idea that the Persians are the first people who formulate their imperial rule as something universal.
That's right.
And indeed moral, that it reflects the kind of the patterning of the universe.
Absolutely.
But just slightly to play devil's advocate. So Cyrus the Great, his fame is immense. And he's famous because he is hugely praised by two people who he conquers. One of them, the Greeks. And the Greeks think he's the model of a great man.
That's right.
And the other, of course, are the Jews. And the Jews in the Bible, he's the Messiah. He's the anointed one, praised as such by Isaiah. But the all we really have from the Persians is kind of tomb inscriptions. So in what sense are the Persians inventing history when they're not actually writing it down in the way that the Greeks and the Jews are?
Well, that's a very interesting point you've made there, Tom. I think that the main thing is that we have to understand is that one of the contributions to history that I think the Persians make is if you understand the way in which history is written. I mean, one of the things that, a sort of mythological narratives and what we might call historical narratives, the Iranians, certainly after the Hellenic period and into the Parthians and the Sasanian period, tend to sort of write a history that is largely mythologically based. I mean, they derive a mythological narrative of their descent. Now, the interesting thing with that is that certainly the Achaemenids tend to sort of get erased from that history in a very detailed sense. But they do exist in the mythological narratives. They are there. And the figure of Kurosh, which is the Persian for Cyrus, does appear in a number of these mythological narratives. He is, however, somewhat demoted in that narrative under the sort of the world kings that exist. So there is a historical narrative. It's just not a historical narrative that we would recognize, but it's a very profound historical narrative that is more mythological in a sense in its construction and full of folklore than the history, you know, the history we would have in terms of the discipline that we would understand it and we collectively would understand it. But I think it's just a different type of history, if I can put it that way. I'm trying hard, but hopefully you will accept my argument.
Ali, take us through some of the things on your list, the things that you think the Persians...
Well, I mean, I think there are a number of things that I've sort of tried to divide. So if we look at... I've sort of dealt with I suppose the political side of it, but there are other things that I think are quite important. Some of the contributions to religion. I mean, we mentioned about the Persian contributions to Islam, obviously, but I think the Persian contributions to religion and religious thought have been pretty impressive. Certainly through Zoroastrianism, and Zoroastrianism was the pre-Islamic religion of Persia or Iran. And Zoroastrianism provided a number of ideas. I know I'm going to get some pushback from Tom, but, let's try.
No, you're not. I completely agree. I completely agree.
You know, in terms of, I mean, some fairly sort of simple things, well, things that we take for granted today, of course, which just shows how effective it's been. This notion of the end of times, for instance, and a spiritual redeemer. These are quite Zoroastrian, you know, and then they're sort of bound in with that sort of Judaic heritage that sort of then come through in Christianity.
Yeah, Ali, because we should say that the people of Judah, of Jerusalem, get taken by the Babylonians to Babylon.
That's right,
and sit by the rivers of Babylon weeping.
So the Jews are in captivity in Babylon and then basically released.
And then Cyrus lets them come back.
Yes, yes.
Which is why the Jews love the Persians.
Do they come back with Persian ideas then? Is that what they say?
Yes, yes, that's the idea. That's the idea.
So Judaism is Persian.
No. I mean, don't worry, you know, let's not exaggerate to diminish the effectiveness of this argument. I mean,
I'm a stranger to that tactic.
Yeah, no, don't do that. No, because I mean, I think the interesting thing is if you look at two biblical texts, I think it's the Book of Daniel and the Book of Revelation. They carry some fairly strong sort of Zoroastrian tropes and ideas in there. I mean, obviously, these are things that scholars far brighter than me will be dissecting and interrogating, looking at these texts. But if you look at the once the Jews returned from the Babylonian captivity, and of course, the main point is a lot of them didn't. A lot of them stayed in Mesopotamia, which is the heartland of the sort of Persian Empire, and imbued a lot of these ideas and sort of produced them. But you can see Zoroastrian ideas coming through, and there's even parts of the text where they sort of say there are words that are being used that are clearly Persian. But the whole notion, for instance, of there's a great concept in Zoroastrian eschatology of a sort of a dragon king.
To the end of days.
Yes, in the end of days. And... although the end of days has a certain circularity to it, but nonetheless, yes, sort of end of days, a sort of great dragon king that is then overthrown and whatever, and then you have peace and justice, as one might hope. And the dragon king, in the way it's described in Zoroastrian texts, has strong similarities, I should say, with the beast in the Book of Revelation. So it's quite interesting. Now, again, none of these are definitive, but in as you know, what would be an ancient history, really, but or any history for that matter. But nonetheless, I think it does make for quite a strong case that there's a huge contribution. I mean, one of the things that I think the Persians have been extremely good at exporting, if I may say so, is religion and religious ideas.
And the whole idea of the world being divided, I mean, Herodotus was saying that the Persians get taught truth. And that, of course, the counterpoint to that is the lie.
The lie,
and the
yes,
sense
absolutely.
Of the world divided into good and evil and light and darkness is obviously hugely strong. So I think we could chalk up that the Persians have invented empire, history, Judaism, Christianity and Islam. So that's not bad. So I think we should probably
I'm not going to go into Judaism, Christianity and Islam.
Okay.
I'm going to say they made significant contributions.
Okay.
It's too late. It's done.
I hear you.
So let's leave it at that and we'll take a break. And when we come back, you'll have some more, I think possibly including gardening. So let's see you then. Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. With me is Dominic, of course, and Ali Ansari, who is talking us through basically why the Persians have invented everything. Ali is giving us his list top 10 things that the Persians have given the world. We've already had empire and we've had religion. So, Ali, what's next on your list of top 10?
Well, the other thing I think is very important is that, you know, the Persians invented paradise. But I suppose it needs a bit of qualification here. Really, the idea of a walled garden that's a planned, you know, and structured garden. This is something that's very closely associated, actually, with the figure of Cyrus the Great, who archaeologists have discovered had a rather spectacular sort of walled garden at his capital in Pasargadae, in southern Iran. And, of course, this Persian affection, shall we say, for the natural world. I'm going to make a claim here, actually, that they're really the original environmentalists, by the way. So you can see where I'm going.
By that,
You know, the Green Party really did start in Iran. This sort of affection for the natural world, gardens, the sort of the order and beauty of the natural world, I think is something that's very closely associated with the Persians throughout history, actually. But one that, you know, you even find, you know, European commentators and others, you know, commenting on it. There's a lovely, lovely narrative that I've read, which actually I believe comes from Xenophon, actually. But Tom, again, you can sort of correct me, where a Spartan king goes to visit Cyrus the Younger in his satrap, his governor's palace in Sardis, and comments very generously about the splendid nature of his garden, and says, you know, you must congratulate your slaves for having, you know, done so much work. And of course, Cyrus the Younger laughs, and rather he says, no, you know, I've done this by my own hand. And the Spartan king is rather shocked at this, that he should sully his own hands by getting in the dirt and all this. But Cyrus says that, this is Cyrus the Younger, I should stress. Cyrus the Younger says, you know, I always feel it very important that until one has labored with one's own hands, one should not sit down for a meal, you know, and that sort of thing. I mean, it's this sort of idea that let's get out there and let's have a bit of,
I think it's one of the most wonderful things about the Persian Empire, the way the kings are portrayed as great gardeners.
Yes.
That's the role they play. I meant that that one of the ways in which Xerxes is encouraged to invade Greece is they say, well, you know, there's some amazing trees and plants there that you won't have. You know, it's kind of like going to a garden center or something.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to go and collect some more trees for my garden back in Persepolis.
Ali, can I jump in as somebody who's never been to Iran? So I think probably a lot of our listeners won't have been to Iran either. So my perception, which may be completely and utterly false, is that Iran, Tom talked about it as a plateau, is that it's quite a sort of dusty and hot place. So is the paradise, the kind of walled garden, is that a refuge from the heat and the, does it have to be created, or am I completely wrong and is Persia actually much greener and more verdant?
Well, I mean, it's a good question, because of course in the ancient period the argument is that southern Iran was much more verdant than we have today. But it's certainly true, I think your central point is quite true, that it was because of the sparseness of the landscape in some ways that the Iranians developed vast irrigation networks and plans for, you know, water supply. I mean, they were quite skilled at that, and therefore developed, I suppose, these walled gardens as a refuge. Now, that's not to say that the plateau itself, I mean, let's not forget, because there is this sort of, you know, how should we say, rather orientalist view of the Middle East as all being deserts and camels. There are deserts in Iran, obviously, but there are also jungles in Iran. I mean, if you go up to the Caspian and the northern areas, it's very verdant. So it's, you know, there's a whole range of different sort of climate types. But certainly in the south, and I think this sort of idea, the affection for a garden was precisely as you say it, that, you know, it's a way of harnessing nature to provide a refuge, really, in an otherwise rather sort of bleak landscape in some ways.
And those gardens, I mean, I remember going to Esfahan and going to a garden there, and it was kind of quite hot. And you went into the garden and it was cool. Mm. There were fountains, and the synthesis of the vegetation with the architecture was so breathtakingly beautiful. And again, I kept going around Iran and thinking, you know, these places are as beautiful as any I've ever seen. And you can see why the idea of that these walled gardens are the kind of places where God would have walked and talked to man. You can entirely see where it would have come from and how.
But you can see also this sort of notion of the Garden of Eden. You see, of course, I mean, it's this idea of a walled garden, and a paradise on earth, a reflection of that. And you're quite right. You know, the way it's been designed is to, you know, bring a measure of comfort, coolness with the water. The water sort of features are very, very deliberate. in a way to give you that sense of a sort of a little refuge away from the troubles of the world.
So Ali, should we as well as paradise, should we clock up gardening?
Yes, I think so. I think and really the origins of environmental thinking, I think, would be good.
Yeah, Dominic, you happy with that?
Yeah, I'm very happy with that. I buy that.
Yeah, okay.
I like
okay,
it.
Okay, we'll bang them in.
I think that's important.
And it's the word paradise from a Persian word or a Greek word?
It is, yes. It's a Persian word.
Right, and the Greeks then took it. Did they? And then, is that right, Tom, that the Greeks took it and that's how we get it? Okay, interesting. Go on, Ali, give us some more.
So I thought we might move to a little bit of leisure and sport now. Because that would be quite, Now, I would like to think that the Persians invented cricket, but I have, alas, no evidence of this. And there are sort of arguments about polo, of course. I mean, polo is a very prominent, you know, because of the sort of the training it gives. But the one
riding horses, isn't it?
Yeah.
Horses. Horses are a big deal for the Persians,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the horses are a big deal. But I wouldn't want, you know, there are areas where even I won't tread, you know, which is the idea that did the Persians invent the stirrup, for instance? I mean, it's a very, very controversial debate. Yes, I mean, I know Tom would be quite shocked by this. So would the Franks and also the Carolingians. However, there is a suggestion. There has been a suggestion, but I don't want to go there because, as Tom's reaction indicates, it would get me into a lot of trouble. However,
I'm open to all kinds of far-fetched theories. You keep them firing.
You see, one of the great, you know, the Sasanian and the Parthians developed very heavily armored. Mounted, what we would term knights.
Yes, you know, Dominic would like this. Dominic, you're a Doctor Who fan, aren't you? Because they look like Cybermen. They look like Cybermen on horses.
Interesting.
Cataphracts.
And the argument is how did these heavily armoured knights, with their lances, as it happens in many cases, how did they sit upright on their horses? Yeah, I mean, in the sense of they're charging. You see these wonderful sort of friezes in southern Iran of knights sort of basically jousting with each other. Now, the argument is, and I've talked to a number of colleagues about this, they had these very sort of rigid saddles in which they sat in. But, you know, there's an argument that actually the stirrup came from Central Asia through into Iran and the Iranians sort of basically operationalized it.
So stirrups, knights, tournaments.
Knights, chivalry. I mean, chivalry, I'd like to, you know, let's get into all that. I think that's quite important. I think it's very, very underrated in the West because we talk about the Chanson de Roland and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, actually the epic poetry, knightly, courtly love, all this sort of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of this in Persian epic poetry. And I think but in other things, I think also the Iranians are basically the founders of backgammon. Now, you'll hear people say that Iranians are the founders of chess, and a lot of the terms for chess come from
chess. Persia. Came from India, though, didn't it?
And it did come from India. You're absolutely right, Dominic. And I want to reveal my magnanimity and real impartiality there.
You're giving the Indians something.
by not claiming chess. I'm sure a lot of my Iranian colleagues will berate me for that. But I mean, what I would say is the Iranians probably refined the rules and made it workable. But nonetheless, I don't think we can claim that. But backgammon, I think we can claim. Backgammon we can claim. And in terms of leisure and sort of foodstuffs, I am going to make a bid for spaghetti. Now,
spaghetti. Oh, I did not see that coming. Goodness.
Yeah, well, any Italian listeners out there?
Well, I mean, the argument is that, you know, Marco Polo never really got to China. And he picked up a lot of these sort of ideas, you know, that these noodles, in a sense, had come during the Mongol Empire, you know, through to Iran. The Iranians refined it, as we always do, by the way. Always make things better, by and large. And then he took that spaghetti back with him to northern Italy when he returned. So there's an interesting argument, and I'm quite taken by that one.
When you say it's an interesting argument, are you saying that this might conceivably be true, or are you saying it's true?
I'm saying on spaghetti, it's one that I would like to claim. I think there are strong. Well, I mean, you know, where I get into trouble in is when we start claiming things like hummus and stuff, which we can't because our Lebanese friends get very upset. And so, you know, but spaghetti, I think, you know, there's a strong
Ali,
argument,
can I take you back for 1 second from spaghetti back to the knights?
Yeah, sure.
Now, I know we're in the middle of your top 10, so I don't want to delay you too long. Are you able in about one sentence? If the Persians were so great and they had these fantastic saddles and whatnot, why did they lose to Alexander the Great?
Ah, well, there's two things there. One is
two sentences only.
Yeah, those knights didn't develop till after Alexander the Great. One.
Okay.
But two, most of the reason why Iranian states collapse is political rather than military, very simply. It's basically divisions of command. You know, they all busy backstabbing each other. I mean, the other thing that we do very well in Iran is decadence. I actually didn't have that in the list, but decadence is actually pretty good. I mean,
that's a great thing to be good at, though, isn't it? That's I mean, decadence, so, and if I want to be known for anything, it's decadence and depravity.
Of course, I mean, you know, Gibbon has this wonderful notion about, you know, because they struggled to find how to categorize the Persians. You know, they didn't want to put them in the category of barbarians, so they said, well, they're civilized, really, and they're part of the civilized world. And you see that a lot in 18th century European depictions. But Gibbon sort of basically develops this notion that the reason why the Persians aren't doing as well as they might be doing is because actually they've become over-civilized. They've done civilization to the nth degree and therefore become decadent. And I think that's great. I mean,
that's
that
a sort of Orientalist argument, isn't it? They're drinking sherbet and strolling in their paradise gardens.
It does. They do that sort of, but it's also quite a nice idea that, you know, we're so good at civilization, we just overdone it.
You're too good.
On the topic of being too good at civilization, give us some more. We're running out of time.
Right, sorry. There are a couple of other things that I would say. There's, and this is tied with the cavalry notion, is the high heel, which actually was news to me, but it's quite
That's pretty decadent.
There's a couple of fashion things that I would say. In the 17th century, if you look at the changes in fashion in Europe between the early and the later part of the 17th century, there is this is the point when early modern European travellers were going to Iran much more often. And they come back with fashion tips. And a number of them, if you see, you know, Charles II and the others, they all wear these rather extravagant high heels. The reason for the high heels was basically to be able to sort of sit comfortably in the saddle with the stirrup, you see. So you have these sort of boots with heels.
Not to look taller.
Not to look taller, interesting enough. We thought it was, actually. You're quite right, because we had discussed this about all these, you know, Persians with high heels to look very tall. The other one, which a fashion item, I can trace fairly securely to John Evelyn's diaries, actually, in the 17th century, is the adoption of the Persian coat in the 17th century, which was taken in by, which was absorbed by Louis XIV's court, and then, of course, adopted by other courts in Europe.
And so that's ultimately the jacket, the kind of jacket you wear with the suit day. So basically, Persian...
A jacket with lapels. Yeah.
So that is claimed to be the Persian coat.
So the Persians have invented the suit.
The trouser is a Persian item of clothing.
Yes, of course. I mean, the Greeks find that hilarious, don't they?
I mean, look at those Romans in their, you know, lovely outfits. You know, very impractical.
But that's the brilliant thing about the Greeks, isn't it? That they thought the Persians were hilariously effeminate because they wore trousers rather than skirts.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. So these sort of items of clothing that obviously the Europeans have taken and made into their own, frankly, I think you should be very grateful for.
So Ali, when you walk down the street in St. Andrews and you see people wearing coats and trousers, do you feel sort of triggered by their cultural appropriation of your...
you know, as I said, I think the Persians are very giving people. And we think great. You know, I just think that, you know, it'd be nicer if they showed a bit more gratitude, really.
Okay. Well, that's very magnanimous of you.
So, Ali, did you ever watch Goodness Gracious Me? The sketch show?
I didn't.
Well, there was a kind of Indian father talked to his son, and everything's Indian. Mm. So anything that comes on the telly or anything, it's always Indian. We've talked about India in relation to chess. Could I float another topic, perhaps to add to the top 10, which is the British Raj. The British Raj is actually hugely Persian. Because one of the things when I was researching for Persian Fire, the book I wrote about the Persian wars with Greece.
Good plug. Very good
came
plug.
Across it. Slip that one in very, very delicately. Was reading about Lord Curzon.
Yes.
Who went on a trip to Persia.
That's right.
And went to Persepolis, admired it hugely.
And left his graffiti on there. Yes, he left his mark.
As Grand British Lord tends to do. And in due course, he then became Viceroy of India.
Yeah.
And was a tremendous enthusiast for kind of Persian-style court flummery. So do you think there's a case for saying that actually, you know, the British like to think that they were, you know, they were all learning Greek in their boarding schools and things, but actually the British in India were much more Persian than they were Greek.
And I'm very, very pleased you said that, actually, Tom, because there's a couple of things I will outline here on the contribution of British India, which basically, as you quite rightly say, they take over the administration from the Mughal Empire. The Mughal Empire the administration of the Mughal Empire is basically based on Persian models. And it's actually, the language is Persian. If you go out in the Indian civil service, at least till 1857, you have to learn Persian. Persian is the language of administration. It's very striking, actually. And it, you know, it hints also as to why Britain and Iran have such an interesting relationship, I should say, because in many ways, Britain was in charge for 100 years or so of at least one half of the Persianate world, if I can put it that way. Now, we derive a lot of things, and I would like to make a claim. You've tipped me off here, I'm afraid, and I'm gonna go for it now. I'm going to say that the modern civil service, as derived from the Indian civil service, is really borrowed a lot of its ideas and attitudes from the old traditional Persian administration. And one of my favorite terms in all this is the idea of purdah. You know, when we go in politics, yes, the civil service purdah. Well, purdah is really a Persian word, parde, which means curtain. Okay, and or the veil. So basically, when elections start, the civil service goes behind the veil. It goes into purdah. And this is a term directly derived, obviously, from the experience in British India and the Persianate world. So I would agree with you. I mean, I think there's a strong case to be made that many of these ideas of the civil service and its administration that they developed as part of the East India Company, obviously, and then driven in and derived in the 19th century into the British civil service. Yeah, I think there's a case to be made there as well. I mean, I particularly given my current role.
So the British civil service is Persian as well.
Well, it's got deep roots there, I think. Yeah, I mean the Persian vizierate is pretty clear. I mean, there's strong humanist tradition.
So Tom, it's pretty clear now why they lost to Alexander the Great, right? I mean, there are a load of bureaucrats eating spaghetti in gardens with high heels.
Well, as Ali said, decadent.
That's a rather scathing way to look at it. I just think that, you know, the Persians were thinking, oh my God, here come these Western barbarians. I mean, what the hell are we going to do? Let's make them Persian. I mean, that's what they did.
And it kind of worked. So Ali, we've almost run out. And of course, time is a Persian idea as well, isn't it?
Unfortunately,
yes, time. Beginning and end. That's a very Persian idea.
But since we invented time, we should be able to make it more flexible, surely. I mean, we have some prior, I didn't mention science, which I'm sorry to say but there are elements of science and astronomy that would be quite important. But, you know, there you are.
I think you've had gardening in high heels. You don't need science as well. That's overreaching there. But is there any last addition to that list before we reach the end times?
As I said, I would only say things like, you know, element algebra, you know.
Is algebra Persian rather than Arabic?
Yes, because I mean the chap here, it was really Persian. I mean, let's not, you know. I mean, he might have written in Arabic, but that's
right. That doesn't sound immensely convincing to me, but I'll let it go.
Well, Ali, thank you so much. That's fantastic. I think you've conclusively proved to everyone's satisfaction that everything is Persian. And on that note, what else is there to say except thank you very much.
Thank you, Ali.
Thank you.